So let's start this evening's talk. And the topic for this evening's talk is the question of whether Buddhism is a religion or not. And if it is not a religion, what is it? And perhaps you may think that it doesn't matter so much what we call Buddhism, whether we call it a religion or perhaps a philosophy or anything else. But actually, I think it matters quite a bit what we call it, because it influences how people perceive Buddhism, and it also influences their ability sometimes to enter and actually practice the Buddhist path. So I want to discuss this topic a little bit and see what comes out of it and how that relates to our practice of the Buddhist teachings. But first of all, I wanted to say a few words about why I think this question matters. And one of the things that you may have noticed when you fill in your Australian census form, one of the questions they ask on the Australian census is the religion you are. I think it's optional. Is it optional? Not sure. I think it might be optional. But they ask you for your religion. Yeah, and you will notice that Buddhism is listed as a religion. And of course, what that means is that Buddhism, in general, in society, it is regarded as a religion. This is how most people think about it. Yeah, and even though there are arguments that kind of go against this, many scholars might disagree with this, nevertheless, this is one of those questions that you find and how society normally thinks about Buddhist teachings. And what is interesting about that is that you find a lot of people around, especially people who have not grown up in a Buddhist culture, people with a Western background who are born in a society that is not Buddhist, very often they don't actually fill in that particular question of being a Buddhist, even though they have been practicing Buddhist for 20 years, yeah, doing umpteen meditation retreats, they kept the five precepts for the last 5 years or whatever, still they are reluctant sometimes to put in that little square, fill in, tick the box called Buddhist. And this is kind of interesting. There seems to be some kind of psychological reluctance there, yeah, to kind of identify with a particular group or a particular thing. There's something about the idea of Buddhism that can be off-putting for people. If you are a traditional Buddhist, it's a bit different because you're grown up with the system. But for people who are not, often it can be difficult. So this is the sort of thing that made me think when I heard these are more like anecdotes. But when I heard these anecdotes, I started to think, what is the reason for this? What is the cause why it is hard for people sometimes to identify even with a teaching which is so, has so many beautiful aspects to it, as the Buddhist teaching actually has. Another thing which made me think about the same thing is the mindfulness movement that you find around the world. It has become very large in recent years. It's massive. In the West, it far outnumbers, I think, a number of Buddhists, the people who have done mindfulness courses or who believe that mindfulness is a good thing. And again, it made me ask, here is a system, yeah, a technique, a way of meditating, if you like it, that is pretty much taken directly out of Buddhist scriptures. They're taken away, crossed out the word Buddhist, and just call it mindfulness, yeah, and suddenly it attracts more people. If you put Buddhist meditation in front, guaranteed it will attract far less people just by adding the word Buddhism in front of mindfulness or meditation. So again, fascinating. Why is it that people are come to something? If it is called mindfulness, yeah, then it's supposed to be secular, it's supposed to be non-religious. Why do they come to that? But if it has the word Buddhism in front, they don't come. So this is fascinating. And the truth, of course, is that the mindfulness movement, when you compare it to the Buddhist teachings, as I said, it has been taken pretty much out of the Buddhist teachings, but actually it is much more poor in its content than the Buddhist teachings. It's one very tiny aspect of the Buddhist path taken out of context. And of course, that tiny aspect of the Buddhist path taken out of context is not going to be equivalent to the full Buddhist practice of, you know, the Buddhist spiritual life, if you like. And then there was a third thing, and this was much more personal in a sense. And this was when I went back to Norway twice earlier this year, both times because two close family members passed away. My father and sister passed away. And it was very interesting because I did the funeral service. They actually both asked for that, which is actually very nice and very touching. It's a wonderful way of saying goodbye to your family members. But What is interesting about that is that Norway, like Australia, is a very secular society, maybe even more secular than Australia in some ways. And I knew when I was going to do this funeral service is that nobody in the audience, or very few in the audience, would have any kind of affiliation with any sort of religion. They'd be completely non-religious people. Yeah, and you could see people were kind of looking at me, wondering who is this weirdo coming in here. Doesn't really fit with the rest of a group at all. It's very interesting when these things happen. So I knew straight away I couldn't really mention the word Buddhism. Yeah, even though it was my family members who passed away, I shouldn't really mention Buddhism. I gave a talk using Buddhist principles to explain about life and death and what really matters in this world, etc., etc. I used Buddhist principles, but never actually mentioned the word Buddhism. And what is fascinating, from a crowd, quite large crowds of people, hundreds of people came to both of these funerals. And afterwards, people were so interested. Yeah, they were so fascinated by a spiritual approach to life that they had never really encountered before. All they had heard about was Christianity, and they weren't really interested in Christianity at all. Now they were living a very materialistic kind of existence, most of those people. But once they started to hear these teachings, they thought, wow, actually very interesting. And yet, when I first came in, they looked at me as if I was from Mars or something. They were really kind of worried about this fellow. They probably had heard about me because word spreads around. When a son in a family becomes a Buddhist monk, word tend to spread. So they probably knew about it already. But they were still kind of shocked when they saw the reality of what I looked like. So why is it that most of those people don't call themselves Buddhist? Why is it that they are fascinated by the teaching, but actually when they hear the word Buddhism, they are slightly scared? When they see Buddhist symbols, actually it is something that maybe even turns them off. And all of these things are, I think, very interesting from a Buddhist point of view. So my question was, what is it? How can we reduce the entry barriers to Buddhism? How can we take down so it becomes more accessible to people? As far as I'm concerned, these teachings of the Buddha are so powerful, so beautiful. They are really about the very essence of what life is about how to create happiness, to reduce suffering in our life and the life of others. How can we not want to share these teachings with others? At least make them available to others. We don't have to go around trying to convert people. In fact, that goes a bit against Buddhist ideas to do that, but at least make them available. So how can we reduce, how can we bring down the entry barriers so more people can actually get access to this teaching without feeling alienated? Yeah, first time you come into this hall here, I don't know how you felt when it was the first time, maybe some people here the first time today, I don't know. But first time you come in here, you might feel a bit scared. Yeah, there's this big shining Buddha statue up here. Yeah, it's still there. It's large, yeah, it's large, it's golden. And of course, golden in the Christian Bible, the idea of the golden calf, yeah, is a bit dodgy. The worship in the golden calf. So this is a little bit like the golden calf, perhaps, that we have behind here, maybe. And it's very large, quite intimidating, very imposing. You come in, you see some kind of strange fellow wearing some very strange clothes and with a kind of unusual hairdo. Actually, this hairdo is getting more popular over the last few years, but, you know, still a bit unusual. Of course, it is a bit scary. And then at the end of the whole thing, we do some chanting. Everyone bows, yeah, strange rituals, all this. So, of course, it is scary. And I remember the first time I came to a Buddhist monastery, I too was a bit kind of taken aback. I was kind of sitting as far back as I possibly could in the crowd, kind of watching with being a bit kind of worried about what was going on. So how can we reduce the entry barriers? And I think there's a number of things that I've just been talking about, like, you know, having a big golden Buddha statue, whether that really is ideal, especially for beginners. Yeah, when you start out, is that really the best way of presenting Buddhism? And I think probably not. I was recently in Thailand, and very interesting to go to Thailand because it's a very traditional Buddhist country. And we went to the workshop of an artist, one of the monks in Melbourne who was there with me. And they are actually making a Buddha statue in Thailand. Yeah, they have some very good artists, obviously, in Thailand who make Buddha statues. It was a very beautiful Buddha statue. What does beautiful Buddha statue mean? What to me, what it means is that it actually reflects some of the qualities of the Buddha. Yeah, it should be peaceful. It should have a benign kind of facial expression, the feeling of someone who has compassion and care for people, someone who is really, really at peace. Yeah. Yeah, not too bad. So but that is the ideal. So when you come into a room with that kind of Buddha statue, you actually feel the qualities of the Buddha statue almost in the room, because it as if those qualities are like radiating from that Buddha statue. And this Buddha statue was just like that. And then we asked the artist, well, you know, how would you make the Buddha statue different? Yeah, if it was up to you, how would you make it different? And the artist said, well, they have asked for the Buddha statue to be a bronze color, but I would like to have it gold. That's what he said. And then I said to the artist that, well, actually, you know, the idea of having a Buddha statue in gold is a very kind of Thai thing. Yeah, everything is supposed to be gold. But this Buddha statue is coming to Melbourne. Yeah, this is in the West, it's a Western culture, and not only is it a Western culture, but it's a very multicultural culture, just like here. You have people from all kinds of backgrounds. This is, by the way, one of the things I love about this Buddha society, kind of the diversity. It's a wonderful thing that we can work together like this, and it's really great. Same thing in Melbourne, the Buddha society there as well is very, very multicultural, and Buddha society of Victoria. So I explained to him, well, in that context, it's better to have something more neutral, yeah, than something that actually shines and stands out, like golden color. And they said, oh yes, you have a point, yeah? So people actually can relate to it, they can understand what it is. And that was a kind of classic example of that, of understanding what actually turns people on in a Buddha statue, what makes them feel peaceful, yeah, what actually makes them relax and make them more attracted to the Buddhist teachings. So these are the kind of things that I'm thinking of. Another one is, of course, whether we should use monks or lay people to teach. And sometimes people are a bit scared of monks, at least initially. After a while, they are kind of, you know, maybe not scared enough, I think sometimes people say, but actually, initially, you're a bit scared of monks. Rituals, yeah, we can minimize rituals in Buddhism, at least initially again, until you understand what they are about, and then you can come aboard if you like. All of these things are things that are potential entry barriers in Buddhism. But there's another one, and that's the one I want to talk about today here. And that entry barrier is the idea of calling Buddhism a religion. Because I don't know what it was like when you grew up, but when I grew up in Norway, religion was like a big no-no. Yeah, it was like religion to me was this really bad word. It was terrible. I didn't know anyone who was religious. Yeah, it was completely unheard of. Nobody went to church, where I lived anyway. It was utterly unheard of. And so religion was something like really weird, and only strange people did religious stuff. Yeah, that was what it was like where I was from in Norway. And I think sometimes it's a bit like that in parts of Australia as well. So because of that, I've realized that actually, is Buddhism really a religion? And if arguably it is not a religion, then maybe we should promote more the secular side, or maybe the spiritual side, or whatever it is in Buddhism. Yeah, because that is perhaps more likely to draw people to the Buddhist teachings. If people are scared straight away of what Buddhism is, then we have a problem, and we won't be able to persuade them that actually maybe there's something very beautiful here, something that can help them to have better lives, and also help them to help other people as well around them. So this was my starting point when I saw all of these things. And then the next step then is actually to ask yourself, well, first of all, is Buddhism really a religion? If it is a religion, well then fine, we'll have to call it that, but perhaps it isn't. So how do we find out? And one of the first things to realize about the Buddhist teachings is that they are very diverse. Yeah, if you travel around the Buddhist world, you see that Buddhists practice Buddhism in a large number of different ways. And it's very obvious that many people do practice Buddhism as if it is a religion. Yeah, they will pray to the Buddha, they will do all kind of, you know, prostrations, they will do all kind of rituals and all these kind of things that we normally associate with religious practice. So clearly there is a broad strand of Buddhism that actually is religion. So how then do we look at this. And one of the ways that I like to think about Buddhism, one of the things that really matters to me personally, is what did the Buddha actually teach? Yeah, I think there's one thing that all Buddhists will have to agree on, or all Buddhists need to take as a given, that is that the Buddha must have known what he was talking about. He started this thing up. Without the Buddha, there wouldn't be anything at all. There would be no Buddhism, there would be nothing in the whole world, no philosophy of Buddhism. Everything would be gone. Yeah, so what did the Buddha teach? What are his way of thinking about this thing we call the Dhamma, the teaching of the Buddha? Is that a religious practice? Or is it perhaps something else? And if you do that, and this has kind of become quite more trendy, if you like, in large part of the Buddhist world, to try to actually move back again to the more original teachings of the Buddha. It's a large trend in parts of Asia. It is certainly something that I have found very useful myself. I haven't been so interested in cultural Buddhism, but what is the real Buddhism? What is the underlying thing that actually the Buddha taught? And when you do that, you go back to those original teachings, what you find certain characteristics of those teachings that are actually very different from what we normally call a religion. So what are those characteristics? And one of those characteristics is that the founder of Buddhism, the authority of what Buddhist teaching is about, the Buddha is a human being. This is pretty radical, yeah? The main authority in the vast number of religions around the world is some kind of God. It's very hard to find a religion which doesn't have the God as a final authority. In Buddhism, we have a human being as the final authority. And there's something very powerful about that, because it makes Buddhism much more down to earth. Yeah, it makes it much more real. It makes it much more tangible. Here we have a human being realizing something very profound and then teaching other humans. And what that means is that when you start reading the suttas is the word of the Buddha, when you start seeing what the Buddha actually said, it is as if one human being, actually not as if, it is one human being teaching another human being. And you get that feeling in the suttas. Yeah, you get this feeling of the Buddha as a human being. He had so many of the same characteristics as we have. When he was getting older, he had all the characteristics of old age, getting sick, needing to rest all the time, you know, his skin getting wrinkled, his faculties declining. Typical thing that happened when you get older. He had all the same problems before his awakening, the same problems with attachments and desires as everyone else has. So you get this feeling of a human being teaching others when you read the suttas of the Buddha. And that's very powerful. It is because it makes the suttas profoundly interesting, because you know here is someone who had a full understanding of the human predicament, what it means to be a human, and it had found some kind of solution, if you like, some kind of outcome, some kind of escape from parts of that human predicament, and then he was able to teach people afterwards. So the fact that the Buddha is human is actually very important. And it is, unfortunately, it is something that is often lost in large parts of the Buddhist world. Very often in the Buddhist world, you elevate the Buddha to some kind of God, some kind of cosmic principle, something beyond human beings. And in doing that, you destroy part of the beauty of the Buddhist teachings. The fact that it is a human-to-human experience that brings it down to earth, that makes it real, and makes it tangible. Yeah? Each one of us has the ability to reach the same thing that the Buddha himself reached 2,500 years ago. And that is what makes it so interesting here. It's a very important difference between most other religions. And as part of that is also the idea that in Buddhism we don't really focus so much on the supernatural things. There are things in Buddhism which are kind of beyond the ordinary. We wouldn't call it supernatural, because supernatural implies it's beyond nature. And in Buddhism, nothing is really beyond nature. Everything is part of the same kind of, you know, a large scope of things. Everything is included in nature, if you like. So it's not supernatural, but it's maybe supernormal. It's different from how you normally think about the world. But the majority of those supernormal things that you find the Buddha was talking about, actually, they are irrelevant. Yeah, these are things that are consequences of developing your mind in a certain way. You can use your mind in a certain way that is beyond the normal, but actually it is irrelevant to what the Buddhist spiritual path really is about. So we can leave aside everything to do with supernatural, with miracles. All of that is irrelevant in Buddhism. In some religions, the idea of a miracle is very fundamental, very much part, core part of it. In Buddhism, it's a side issue. The only issue in Buddhism, which is kind of perhaps unusual, is the idea of rebirth. And the idea of rebirth is a core aspect of the Buddhist teachings. So that is the idea of the Buddha, the human side of things that is kind of very special for Buddhism. That is one part of it. Another very important part of Buddhism is the idea that the teachings are about seeing reality. Yeah, it's about coming closer and closer to reality. And through our meditation practice, the idea is actually to get more clarity about things, seeing the way things are. This is called the Yatha Bhuta Jnanadasana in the Buddha's word, which means seeing things according to reality. This is the very purpose of the Buddhist teachings. Yeah, the purpose is not faith. The purpose is not to kind of to believe in a certain thing. The purpose is to actually see things according to reality. And this too is kind of extraordinary, and it's very unusual. Of course, in other religions too, they would say that, it is in accordance with reality, but it's still very different, because here the entire purpose is to develop your mind, to follow a path that actually leads you to see things more clearly and eventually make some kind of breakthrough through that kind of insight. This is the whole Buddhist path moves in that direction. And in many ways, if you think about it, it is very similar to science. Yeah, science is also about discovering reality. It's about investigating nature. What is nature in all its various respects? And Buddhism actually follows the same path. It's about understanding the nature of certain things, specifically the nature of the mind and the nature of the body. In other words, the nature of what it means to be a human being. That is what it's all about. So it's about a kind of a journey of discovery. Yeah, finding out what is really going on there. So it kind of, in that sense, it's the same as science, because it is a first person discovery, but the aim is the same thing. It's moving towards the same thing. And for this reason, Buddhism should not really contradict scientific understandings of the world. Yeah, if science has a certain understanding of the world that is well established through the scientific method, Buddhism should actually align with that. And it was very interesting. Many years ago, I think it was the Dalai Lama, he said that if your beliefs as a Buddhist, if they don't fit with scientific understanding, we should throw them out. Yeah, this is kind of a Buddhist attitude. Why is that a Buddhist attitude? Well, because Buddhism is a search for truth. Wherever truth is to be found, whether it is in the scientific realm or it is in the inner realm or whatever it is, we should accept it as truth. And if there is a conflict between science and Buddhism, then we need to ask ourselves what the problem is. Is there a resolution so we can resolve that problem? Because there shouldn't really be a conflict. If there is conflict, something has gone wrong, and we need to sort it out. So this is also radical. I mean, most religions would never say anything like that, throw out your beliefs if it contradicts science. This, again, is a very Buddhist attitude, a Buddhist way of doing things. And from that follows a very beautiful piece of advice that the Buddha gives in one of his famous suttas. This is a sutta known as the Kallama Sutta, where the Buddha meets a group of people called the Kallamas in the north of India, and they have a conversation. This is a very common way for the Buddha to teach, teaching through conversation, because conversation is often much more effective than lecturing to people. Why am I sitting here lecturing? If conversation is better. Okay, too late. It's already happening. I better carry on with the lecturing. But it's true, right? Because if you are having a conversation, you have a kind of ability to go back and forth a little bit. There's more ability to have interaction. So actually, it's important that we have a lot of conversation and proper, dialogue in Buddhism, rather than just kind of teaching and one person kind of, setting forth his or her ideas about what is going on. So he comes to these Kallamas, and these Kallamas, they are group of people who are really confused about the spiritual life. They say to the Buddha, oh, we have all these we have all these various teachers. Yeah, they come here. And some people say that there is another world, that there is a rebirth. Some people say there is no rebirth. Some people say that it's good to be virtuous and moral. Some people say it's no good to be virtuous and moral. And they said to the Buddha, we are confused. We are in doubt. We don't know who to believe. Who should we believe? And then the Buddha says, and this is kind of what is so radical about this. Yeah, this is what is so nice about it. He says, it is good to be in doubt. It's okay to be confused. Why? Because you have doubt about a doubtful thing here. So the idea is in Buddhism, doubt is okay here. Not only is it okay, doubt is encouraged. If something is doubtful, if something is uncertain, you should have doubt, yeah? You shouldn't kind of pretend to be certain about something when actually there is grounds for doubt. And this is another thing which kind of fits in with the idea of searching for truth. We are searching for truth here. We're moving towards finding out what reality actually is like. And to do that on that path, it is natural that sometimes there will be doubt. So please don't be afraid of having doubt. When you come here and you bow down to this Buddha statue, first of all, you don't have to bow down if you don't like to bow down. But if you do, it doesn't mean that you have to throw out all doubt at the same time. Yeah, you can bow and say, okay, Buddha, I bow to you, but still, I have a bit of doubt. Yeah, you can say that to the Buddha as you bow down. And that's okay. That's acceptable in this Buddhist tradition. That's kind of freeing, isn't it? It's liberating. You don't have to be certain about things. You don't have to say, yeah, I'm a real Buddhist. I believe in everything that the Buddha said, no doubt at all. You don't have to say that, because actually there are many things that you probably should doubt about the Buddhist teachings, or at least should be uncertain about, yeah? Why? Because you don't know it for yourself. If you don't know it for yourself, there will be, by definition, a degree of uncertainty there. Huh? So, this is what Buddhism is about, the movement towards truth. Maybe I should say a little bit about why the movement towards truth is so important. You may wonder, well, why truth? What does truth matter? I came here to kind of just become a bit peaceful and happy. You know, what this truth business, you know, I'm not sure if I want too much truth. Truth can be scary, right? Sometimes, too much truth, don't want to see too much truth. But the reality is that if you really want to be happy, if you really want to be peaceful, you have to see the truth. Why is that? Well, it's very obvious, because in our entire lives, we base our decision on the facts of existence. Yeah, if you don't know the facts, if you are deluded about something, if you invest in the wrong company, if you do something which is silly because you have the facts wrong, you're going to suffer. You're going to suffer a loss. You're going to do the wrong thing because you don't understand the situation. All happiness, all contentment, all peace, all positive results in life or on the spiritual path come from understanding things as they actually are. When you understand things in the right way, then you can make good decisions, yeah? Only then can you make a good decision. If you don't see things in the right way, how can you make a good decision about where to find happiness and where to find suffering, yeah? So the idea here is that truth, seeing things in the right way, and happiness are very closely conjoined. In fact, they are actually two sides of the same coin. Truth and happiness almost always must come together in this way, yeah? So searching for truth is so fundamental, and that truth, of course, can be approached gradually through meditational practice, through greater clarity, through greater insight. So these are the things that make the Buddhist teaching so, to me anyway, so incredibly fascinating. Who doesn't want more truth? And if you can have kind of a bit of happiness on top of that truth, jeepers, doesn't get much better than that. Truth and happiness combined, wisdom and bliss, wisdom and supreme peace. Is anyone kind of keen on that? Does that sound all right? Yeah, sounds pretty good, right? And this is how we should really kind of, you know, this is the right way of thinking about the Buddhist teachings. Are these things religious? Well, not really in the ordinary sense of the word, yeah, because it differs so much from religion, how we normally think about it. But there's one more thing, yeah, and this is the most powerful thing of all in all Buddhist teachings. The Buddha was once asked, what is the difference between your teaching and all other spiritual teachings? And I'm sure some of you know the answer, is that right? I'm just looking around, see if any nodding heads around here. there is one thing that kind of distinguishes the Buddha's teaching from all other teachings. And the Buddha says that is the idea of non-self. Yeah, the idea that there is no permanent entity, there is no permanent core in human beings. Ultimately, if you keep on with introspection, trying to find out what is really going on inside of you, what your mind is like, you cannot find a core. You cannot find some kind of inherent existing entity inside. Also, the implication of that as well is that also there cannot be any inherent existing entity outside, because the idea of a creator God is really just a mirror image, or a permanent God is the mirror image of the sense of permanence inside of us. So those two things, if you see one of those, you also see the other one. It falls away at the same time. And this is really radical. This is really, really radical stuff, because if you look at almost all ideas of religion in the world, all ideas of religion in the world have some idea of permanence, something which is essentially there. It is called the soul, it is called maybe the creator God or whatever it is. And when you move away from that, you're moving away from almost everything else in the world. And not just that, but you're actually moving away from that which feels natural to us. It feels like we exist in a certain way. It feels that we are some kind of inherent essence inside of us that goes with us from the moment we are born to the moment we die. Yeah? And so it goes against kind of the grain. And this is why it is so fascinating. And it's really something that you can only uncover by introspection, profound introspection based on very deep and still and peaceful states of mind. You may think, I don't know what you think, but you may think that this is just in agreement with how modern psychology and philosophy views the human being, as, you know, as a, there's nothing inherent, a psychologist will say there's nothing inside of you, it's all just fluctuating. You may think that is the same thing, and if you do think that, I don't know, you would be mistaken, because it's not exactly the same thing. Because if a psychologist or philosopher looks inside and asks, is there anything inherent there? It is a very superficial view of it. It is not really dealing with the actual emotional experience of what it means to be an I, a me. You have only looked at it from a third-person perspective. You haven't really, it hasn't really had a deep effect on your psychology. But in Buddhism, the idea here is actually to look at these things in a deep way so that it actually does, has a massive effect on who you are as a human being. When you see these things, you are released from a delusion, says the Buddha. Yeah, and this is kind of the point here, because when you see that, that is when you overturn your understanding of what the world actually is like. This is a very profound part of the Buddhist teachings, but this is at core what Buddhism is about and why it is so profound and why it is so counterintuitive and why it is not really a religion in terms of a dogma, but it is a profound insight into the nature of reality. So all of these things, to me, they point to Buddhism being something very different from what we normally call a religion. Yeah, all of these things I've been talking about, the idea that there is, you have a human being as the final teacher rather than a god. Yeah, the idea that we are searching for truth, that it should align with scientific facts, and the idea that we even reject something as basic in many religions as the idea of an inherent essence in human beings or an inherent essence in the universe, what perhaps you might call a god. So because Buddhism is so different, if you call it a religion, I think we are shortchanging Buddhism. Because we are actually grouping it together with all of these other teachings that are so different from what Buddhism is like. So I think we are shortchanging it. So I think it is better to find some other terminology, to call it something else, rather than actually mixing it up with other kind of philosophies, other kind of ideas that really are very different from what Buddhism is all about. So what then can we call Buddhism if it's not a religion? Or maybe it is a religion, but maybe we still want to move away. It depends how we define these things. A religion is a very amorphous term, and it doesn't really have a very clear definition. You go on the internet, you look in dictionaries, everyone defines it differently. After a while, you just give up. And you say, okay, I will look I will try to investigate this through my own insight and come to some kind of understanding what this is about. So if it is not a religion, what then might it be here? And one of the other things that Buddhism is sometimes called, it is sometimes called a philosophy here. Yeah. This is a very common thing. If you kind of Google on the internet, you ask, what is, Mr. Google, please say, what is Buddhism? And philosophy is one of the top kind of, you know, or maybe it's Miss Google, I'm not sure actually it was Mr. or Miss Google, but anyway, and philosophy is one of the top results, yeah, that it is a kind of philosophy here. Is that correct? And, well, again, it depends on what kind of Buddhism we are talking about. The idea of Buddhist history is so vast, yeah, over 2,500 years. And a lot of the later Buddhist history, there's a lot of philosophy in that. In fact, this is one of the things that Buddhism is famous for, is all the philosophical treatises and things that have been written over 2,500 years. It's about explaining the universe. It's about dividing up the mind and the body into atomic units, showing how it all kind of fits together, yeah, into minute particles and all of these kind of things. And this is the project of what is called the Abhidhamma. The Abhidhamma is sometimes known as the higher Buddhist teachings. Yeah, but actually what they really are is they are philosophy. It's a way of thinking about the world, a way of speculating about the structure of existence and the structure of the mind. And really, it is no more than a mental construct. And that is what philosophy is. Yeah, it's a construct, a thought construct based on certain assumptions. But is that what Buddhism is? Well, again, let's go back to see what the Buddha said. Later Buddhism, yes, that may be a philosophical construct, and actually it is, and that is why I think we should maybe reject some of that later Buddhism, or at least not take it so seriously, because it is really just philosophy. Early Buddhism is quite different. And this again is why it is quite interesting, because what does the Buddha say that his teaching is? And what he says, and this is found again in one of the famous discourses of the Buddha called the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the discourse of the Buddha, final passing away. And what the Buddha says, his teaching is, he says it is something known as the 37 Bodhipakya Dhammas, which means aids to awakening. Yeah, he says to his disciple, all his monks are around, and he says to his monks, and the nuns are probably there as well, and maybe it's probably some lay people in the assembly as well, and he says, I'm going to die soon. When I have died, I would like you to look after this teaching for the benefit of humanity for a long time into the future. What is that teaching that you should remember and look after for the long time into the future? It is these 37 Bodhipakya Dhammas, these 37 aids to awakening. So what are these 37 aids to awakening? And if you look at them, you will see they're all about practical things. They are pragmatic. They are about how to practice the Buddhist path, how to make sure that we develop ourselves in a certain direction. It is the Noble Eightfold Path, the seven factors of awakening, the five spiritual faculties, the four right efforts, and all of this. This is what these 37 Bodhipakya Dhammas are. So it's all super practical. It's about how to develop, how to change ourselves. It's about a spiritual practice and path. It is not really about a philosophical system at all. Yeah, so there's nothing there which really is philosophical. And this is why it is so interesting again. Philosophy does not form part of the early Buddhist teachings. And then some people say, well, what about rebirth? Yeah, surely rebirth is some kind of metaphysical idea, metaphysical, yeah, in the sense of being a philosophical speculation, yeah? So rebirth, clearly, you know, nobody knows about rebirth, that must be some kind of philosophy, yeah? But actually, from a Buddhist point of view, rebirth is not metaphysics, it's not philosophy, yeah? Rebirth as well is something which is discovered, yeah? The Buddha says, I have seen that there is rebirth. You too can see this. I'm not telling you because it is a philosophical position. I'm telling you because this is the nature of reality as far as I have seen, as far as I have understood reality. So for someone who is not a Buddhist, it may look like philosophy, but from a Buddhist point of view, this is just another part of experience, another part of insight into the nature of reality. So really, there is no speculation in early Buddhism. The Buddha claims, yeah, this is what he says, and if you gain some confidence in the Buddha after reading some of his suttas, then you start to maybe appreciate some of these claims. He claims, everything I teach is only what I have experienced and nothing outside of it. Okay, the odd simile, the odd allegory, the odd story here and there, yeah, but that's of course par for the course. But essentially, it is nothing but what I have experienced and seen for myself. So there's no philosophy either. So if Buddhism is not a religion, it is not a philosophy, what is it? Is it anything at all? What? It must be something. At least it is Buddhism, right? It is Dhamma. It must be something. What is it? So how do we approach this? Well, again, if we're going to approach this question, again, we can ask ourselves, what did the Buddha say about these things? And a few things that the Buddha said about his own teaching. One of the very simple things that I kind of comes to mind when I'm talking about this topic, the Buddha says that most people, except if you are fully awakened, it is rare even to be sane for even a few moments. Even a few moments of sanity is rare in the world, except if you have reached full awakening. Yeah? So in other words, the Buddha is saying that there is, in Buddhism, we are moving from a state where we are deluded, slightly nuts, maybe. Yeah, we're all a little bit nuts, according to the Buddha. Are you okay with being a bit nuts? I apologize for kind of breaking the news to you, but this is a bit harsh way of doing it. But according to Buddha, we're all a bit nuts. Yeah? Why? Because we get angry sometimes. Sometimes we have all these stupid desires, desires which doesn't lead us anywhere, desire that leads to suffering in the long run. How come we have a desire that leads to suffering when we actually want to be happy? That's why the Buddha says we are a bit nuts, because we're doing things that lead to our own suffering, even though we want to be happy. That is almost like the definition of nuts, right? And we are, of course, deluded about things. This is kind of the whole point. This is what delusion means, that you think you are pursuing happiness when actually you end up pursuing suffering. So this is one of those beautiful sayings of the Buddha. It's rare in the world to find a person who is even sane for just a few moments. And then you start to look at the Buddhist path. I was just talking about the 37 Bodhipakka Dhammas a minute ago, these 37 aids to awakening, supports for awakening. And if you analyze those 37, you pull them all apart, you kind of line them up in a big line, and you pull out the ones that are the same, put them in little groups. And when you put them in little groups, so they put the same kind of qualities together, what you find is that there are certain qualities that are found again and again in these 37 factors. One of them is right effort, or effort or energy. What does that mean, right effort? Well, in Buddhism, right effort means the effort to change the way we think, to reflect differently, to reflect in the way that makes us and the people around us more happy. Moving away from anger and ill will, moving towards more compassion, understanding of other people. This is kind of the core of what right effort is about. It's about mental development, really. And there's another group which has about 9 factors. I have actually counted all these factors, you can trust me, because I do these things sometimes. I sit there, I count 1, 2, 3, and I came to 9, so hopefully my counting is correct. 9 factors of right mindfulness. Right mindfulness is satipatthana. This is all about developing your mind in meditation practice. 9 factors of that. Again, it's about mental development. Then there's another group, and this is the samadhi or samadhi part, the deep states of meditation you can have as you practice these teachings another 9 times. Okay, so I don't know if you have been, following closely what I've been saying? Okay, so 9 plus 9, 18, right? Is that right, Venerable? He's a mathematician. I should ask you. Like 18, right? And then plus 8, 26? 26, okay. Thank you. I have the alibi here. He is the computer sitting next to me. He's actually a mathematician. It's actually true. I'm not just joking here. So even mathematicians are supposed to be the most logical people. Even they become monks. That says it all, right? So we have it's a very kind of rational teaching. That's the conclusion, I guess. Anyway, so we have 26 out of 37 factors. And what are they about? Right effort, right mindfulness, right samadhi, all about mental development. Yet this is the essence of the Buddhist path. This is what it really is about. It's about moving the mind, transforming the mind in a certain way. From, I just mentioned before, from being a little bit nuts, yeah, to being, what is the opposite of nuts? Sane? Anti-nuts? Anti-nuts? No, non-nuts? I don't know. Anyway, you know what I mean, yeah? We move from being nuts to the opposite of nuts. All about mental development. That is what it really is about. So this is what these 37 factors are talking about. And of course, before you even come to that mental development, before that, we have all the factors of virtue in Buddhism, how to practice virtue in the right way, how to practice kindness to other people. That too, surprisingly, is about mental development. Because when you are kind to other people, when you have to be compassionate in your life, you decide to treat people well, not to be angry, not to do bad things, how does that happen? It happens because you are gradually changing your mind. You're looking at people in a different way. That is the only way you can be virtuous. If you really practice virtue thoroughly, practice kindness as much as you possibly can, you are changing as a person. You know what I mean? Yeah, gradually your mind is coming along. It is actually a mental development that is going on underneath that virtue and kindness that you're practicing. The whole Buddhist path is about mental development, going from a state of less clarity, of less insight, less understanding, towards more and more clarity, more happiness, all of these positive things. That is what Buddhism is about. What does that sound like? To me, it sounds like psychology. Yeah, we're trying to change our mind. We're trying to move our mind from one state to another one. If we really grieve, we're really sad, we're really suffering, we try to overcome that. This is part of the Buddhist practice. If we think in the wrong way, we try to think in better ways. If we are not so happy, we try to become more at peace, at ease, even happy, even experiencing bliss in meditation practice. This is what this whole path is about. It is really a psychology. That is what Buddhism is about. And once you understand that, I think you have understood really how these teachings work, what they are about. It's about the inner life of each one of us and how we transform our inner lives from something, what we are now, to something better, something more positive, something more bright, something more beautiful in the world, so we can become a beacon for ourselves and also the people around us. Maybe you think that calling Buddhism a psychology is a bit dry, perhaps. Yeah, maybe it is a bit dry, but I think it is much closer to the reality than calling it perhaps a religion or a philosophy, because it is about working with the mind, and it tells people straight away what these teachings are about. So maybe you could call it something like a spiritual psychology, yeah, because it has a spiritual aspect in the sense of moving in a particular direction, a particular purpose to it, yeah, towards more happiness and well-being in the world. You can maybe call it a liberation psychology or even a liberation spirituality, because we're trying to liberate ourselves and others from problems, from suffering, from defilements, from all of these negative things in our life. And that is what Buddhism really comes down to. And I think if you think about that this is a psychology of liberation. Yeah, a psychology which takes human beings and shapes them into something more positive, something more bright, something more beautiful. Then you also understand that Buddhism really touches on the very meaning of life itself. Because this is what life is all about. It is what everyone wants in this world. And I think once we can get it across that Buddhism is a psychology about the very meaning of life, that takes you from an ordinary place to something very bright and very powerful and very extraordinary, then we will be able to sell these Buddhist teachings and make them more meaningful also for the population in the world that might be skeptical about religion, skeptical even about philosophy, because this is what Buddhism really is about. Okay, I'm going to stop there because I'm not sure what to say anymore. So let's stop at this point. Okay, so if anyone has any questions or comments, you are welcome to ask at this particular point.
Ajahn, can I ask a question? Would it be...
Where are you? There, okay, good. All right, Boon, okay, please, yeah, fire away, yeah.
Would it be fair to say that the idea of religions and philosophy actually a byproduct of practicing what the Buddha taught?
Religion and philosophy are a byproduct of practicing what the Buddha taught?
Yes.
I think sometimes they are a byproduct of not practicing what the Buddha taught. Yeah, I think this is partly the problem, because I think if people really practice the Buddha's teachings, they wouldn't be interested in philosophy, nor will they be interested in what I consider standard religious exercises or expressions, because they would be so involved with the practice of purifying their heart, of doing what is right, of living well, of doing all these things, that actually those extra things, and philosophy really is a thing that you do, you know, to create a kind of system out of things. It is something which is, I think, is for, you know, if you have a lot of restlessness, then philosophy maybe is really good. But if you want to focus on the core aspect of liberating the mind and kind of living the spiritual life, I think philosophy very often falls by the wayside. It is actually a distraction from the path. Religion, I think the word religion is so manifold, yeah, and I think that the word religion sometimes can be a good word, sometimes not so good. It really depends on how you use it. So religion may be an outcome of these things, but religion, when it's taken in the wrong direction, towards too much ritual, too much pure faith without any kind of, you know, common sense and these kind of things, that's when it becomes problematic. And this again is, a bad outcome of the spiritual practice, not a positive outcome. It's somewhere we shouldn't go, basically, and we should bring it back to the pure spiritual and psychological teachings of Buddhism. Yeah. Okay. Anyone else want to say anything? Yeah.
Thank you, Ajahn. Always very interesting, very enjoyable. I'm just curious about other lineages. For instance, they talk about the medicine Buddha, Amitabha Buddha, Buddha of the Pure Land,
yeah,
heavenly beings. Surely they aren't defying the Buddha's teachings, because, you know, you're completely against all that. And yet some other Buddhist traditions, they love all that. That's their... You know, that's their spiritual practice. Yeah. That's what they believe in. That's what they, you know, that's their heart. And they believe that that is where goodness is.
Yeah.
So could you please talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Thank you.
So the medicine Buddha and the Kuan Yin, the Amitabha Buddha,
Kuan Yin,
these things.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm not really completely against that. I wouldn't go that far. I would just say that they are a development of the Buddha's teachings from what the Buddha taught, and they have taken the Buddha's teaching in a different direction from what the Buddha taught. And I think that is okay, but there are certain historical reasons why it took that particular path. Yeah, there is a really good book about the development of the Bodhisattva ideal, which is, I would recommend you to read it. I think it's called The Genesis of the Bodhisattva Idea, or something like that. It's available online by a monk called Venerable Analayo, who wrote this particular book. And it's a very good book that shows you how the Bodhisattva ideal basically emerged from early Buddhist ideas and then became the mainstay of Mahayana Buddhism later on. It's not part of early Buddhism, but it evolved from that. And of course, you can practice that Mahayana Buddhism in good ways. Yeah, of course, it can have a positive impact on people. It depends how they do it. But what my point is not to kind of talk down all of these things. I don't want to really talk down. There are lots of good Christians in the world, good Muslims in the world, good atheists in the world. There's lots of good people out there. And anyone who is a good person, I would respect. My point is more, if in the final analysis, what we want to do, we want to come back to what the Buddha taught. If we're going to practice this path fully, if we're going to understand these things from the Buddha's point of view, and the Buddha is the refuge that we all have in common, whether we are Theravada Buddhist or Mahayana Buddhist or Vajrayana Buddhist or Hahayana Buddhist. That's Ajahn Brahm, the Hahayana Buddhists. Whatever kind of Buddhist you are, comes back to the teaching of the Buddha. So we should all come back to that. And if you want to take the Buddha's teachings to its most powerful and ultimate point, you have to come back to those teachings. And that is really, I think, what Anyway, that's what how I look at this. I don't want to talk down the other aspects of Buddhism, but I want to say, in the end, come back to where it all started out.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Can I say something?
Yeah.
Sorry. Ajahn Brahmali, yeah. I see Buddhism as a pathway, you know, a pathway through mental development towards awakening or enlightenment, okay, to end human suffering.
Mm.
It is certainly not religion. Mm. In religion, you know, that definition, religion, there's a belief in God, you know. So it's certainly not a religion. Yeah. And to call Buddhism a philosophy is an insult to Buddhism, you know. Okay? People like Socrates, Aristotle, yeah. Plato, Confucius, Taoism, they are what I call philosophers of philosophy. Yeah.
Yeah.
Buddhism goes deeper than that.
Yeah. Okay, thanks. Thank you, Eddie. Yeah. Very good. Okay, yeah. I'm not sure if it needs a comment, so I'll just leave it at that. So, anyone else want to say anything here? Everyone else is kind of chilled. Okay, Drew, okay.
One more.
Down there. Okay. Yeah.
You spoke about letting go, in general terms, in Buddhism, you let go. That's sort of not always easy because when you look around with many things, even with donations, the bushfire appeal and these charities, and you begin to wonder whether they do go to the intended people. So these little things sort of bug you in life, you know, and depending on what you are bringing and what your ethics are, it just tends to keep bugging you, you know. So would you say Buddhism is then about learning to live in an imperfect world and we just tolerate it and don't go for perfection and just get the hell out of here and attain nirvana, you know, sort of. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, Buddhism is certainly about contemplating the fact that the world is imperfect. That's a very important part of Buddhist contemplation. Yeah, the idea that the world is unreliable, that it is out of control, that it is always changing. You don't know, you give a donation, you don't know where it's going to go, your fires are coming. I mean, the bushfires in the eastern states have been horrific. It's been like, I mean, it's an infernos almost. It's really kind of out of this world. And you start to understand how out of control things really are when you see these things. Nobody can control it, yeah? And so this is a very important part of Buddhist contemplation because it gives you a very clear idea of the limits of human existence. The more you understand the limits of human existence, the more interested you become in the spiritual path. Because if the external world is out of control, if the climate is out of control, if politics are out of control, and all that really seems to be absolutely out of control, it's never going to be the way you want it to be. But not only that, but our relationships are out of control. Yeah, our private lives are out of control too. Everything outside of us is out of control. And the only place where we have some degree of control really is in our inner lives. And the inner lives is the spiritual path. That's what it's all about. This is kind of what I've just been talking about. Yeah, developing your mind, developing your spiritual practice. So all of that contemplation about the external world is very important because it shows you that there is no hope really in that external world. It comes and goes. A problem is resolved. Another problem arises. Then it goes better. Then it goes worse. It just goes round and round and round. There is no solution there. And sometimes if you haven't got a spiritual path, you despair. You despair because you start to get depressed because everything seems to be going wrong. And this is where the spiritual path comes in, because you start to understand what has real value in this world. What has real value is our inner life and our inner development. All the external things don't actually have any value in the long run, because in the long run, they're always going to let you down. When you die, everything has to go. Yeah? When you die, everything you have built up in this life is going to go. It's a very powerful contemplation. The more you understand that, the more you start to look at the inner life instead and contemplate the inner life instead. That is what the real message is. And it's a very, many ways, very simple thing to understand, but also very profound. Because if you take it to its utmost consequence, basically you become a very, you turn around your life and you become a very spiritual person rather than being a materialistic person.
Hi, Ajahn.
Hello, Frank. Yeah.
Your talk is incredible. I'd like to ask you a question. This horrific bushfire, okay, in the Eastern Seaboard, in fact, in WA, do you regard this as part of impermanence or part of climate change?
Okay, well, it's both. Yeah, it's to me, it is obvious that it is part of climate change because these things are so unprecedented. But it's also part of impermanence. Climate change itself is an aspect of impermanence. Yeah, it shows the world is really out of control. And even though we have known about climate change for a long time, for decades, we have kind of the science has been there for a long time, the vested interests have been so strong that we haven't been able to do anything about it. This is kind of what is so astonishing about this whole thing. It shows you how out of control it is. We think we have all the evidence, so therefore we should be able to do something about it. But despite the evidence, we can't, because we are blocked by other forces that counteract our ability to do something with these things. So it is both climate change and impermanence at the same time. And that is really, I think, the problem there. And that's the right way of thinking about it. Okay. Anyone else? Yes? Okay. Yep. Time to take some external questions. Okay. Thank you. Drew, are you okay? You happy? Next time, okay. Beginner's question.
Yeah. Yes or no. So with the mindfulness, people ask me sometimes about it, and I really consider myself still, you know, would the Buddhist definition of mindfulness be simply a moment-to-moment awareness of your mind activity without your conscious awareness?
Yeah. Mindfulness basically means that the point about mindfulness is that it doesn't specify the object. Yeah, you can choose the object. That's the point of it. So it doesn't have to be awareness of your mind. For example, if you are reading a book, yeah, and you are fully aware of what you're reading, you are mindful, but you are mindful on what is in the book. So mindfulness is not specific to the object. Mindfulness just means that you have awareness. You know what is happening here. Yeah. So, of course, if you are on a spiritual path and you want to kind of change your mental state, then awareness of the mind is a good idea, because then you can actually, you know, when things go wrong, you can do something about it. But mindfulness in itself is just the ability to be aware of whatever you are, whatever object you have at the moment.
So, when people say, what's the difference between the mindfulness-based therapy and Buddhist mindfulness?
Yeah. Maybe. I don't know how all these other therapies work, but possibly, yeah, it could be. But it's much more than that, because in Buddhism, the idea is that mindfulness doesn't stand on its own. Yeah, it comes with all these other factors. That's why you have a Noble Eightfold Path. You have eight factors, and mindfulness comes with virtue, with morality. And without morality, mindfulness is going to be very weak. Why? Well, it's obvious, because if you are a moral person, you tend to feel good about yourself. It's easy to be in the present moment. Yeah. So morality, when you think about it, it's bleeding obvious what's going on. But this is why I think Buddhism has such a major contribution to make to these kind of things, like the mindfulness movement or whatever. It's a shame that they have just taken out this one factor, because it destroys the potential even of the mindfulness movement, the fact that they're not taking on board everything else. Yeah. Okay, anyway, so let's take a few questions from outside of here. The first one is from Kat in Germany. If Buddhism is based on seeing the truth, how does rebirth fit in this, since you can only believe in it? Okay, so how about rebirth? How does that fit into the idea of seeing the truth? Well, there are lots of things that you can't see straight away, yeah? So, for example, you may be told by an advanced meditator that in meditation you can experience lots of bliss and happiness. Well, if you are told that, most people will believe it. Because why not? Why shouldn't you be blissful in meditation? Sometimes you may see meditators who look really blissed out. And then, of course, that gives you some indication that that may be true. But until you actually experience it, you don't know whether it's true. And rebirth is a similar kind of thing. Rebirth is in principle something you can see for yourself, but it may take some time before you get there. It is not in principle outside of your experience. You can actually know it in this very life. And that is the point of it. That's what I mean. It is part of experience rather than part of some kind of belief system or faith system. Okay, next one is from D from the USA. It's a very short name, D. Okay, so hello D. What is the Buddhism teaching and or philosophy on handling money, banking and economy, keeping the five precepts at the same time in lay life? The Buddhist philosophy on handling money is that it is a bad idea if you are a monk or a nun. Yeah, we should not be handling money, but if you are a lay person, you can handle as much money as you like. You can handle millions of dollars if you want to. I'm not going to say that. So sometimes you're just better to shut up. So I'm going to shut up. So there is no real problem. Of course, the point with money is that it is good not to be too attached to these things. One of the reasons why it is good to be not too attached is because eventually you're going to have to give it up. It can only last so long. At the very latest, on your deathbed, it's all going to have to go. So useful not to get too attached to these things and to finding happiness, the real happiness, in a deeper place than actually you can take with you even after you die. So again, that's the importance of rebirth right there. Keeping the five precepts at the same time in lay life? Yes, there is no contradiction between keeping the five precepts and handling money. Yeah, both are perfectly okay. Handling money is really an issue for monastics and not so much for lay people. Okay, last one is from Chrissy in Melbourne. Does it matter if Buddhism is thought to be a religion or not? Or does it matter more that people are getting something out of the teachings in whatever way they are? I agree, it doesn't really matter. It really only matters if you have a hang-up with the word religion. Yeah, that's when it matters. Because if you have a hang-up with the word religion, you're going to be turned off if you say, yeah, come to Buddhism, it's a really good religion. And that would be the truth in my case, because certainly when I was young, I had a serious hang-up with religion. And when I became a Buddhist, the last thing I told my friends was to say that I had become religious. I become a Buddhist. It is not a religion. Yeah, it's different. That is kind of how I could live with myself in the early days. So it depends on the situation. There's nothing wrong really with calling it anything you like. That is not the problem. The problem is how to make it accessible to people in a way they can actually understand what it is about. That is really the point of this. So how can we make it maximum accessible to other people? And I think sometimes we need to go beyond the idea of religion. We need to explain it in more detail, that it is really a psychology, that it is about attaining, you know, all the kind of benefits that a spiritual path can afford you. And this is really what Buddhism, at the end of the day, is all about. Okay, so that is all for tonight. So let's pay respect to the Buddha Sangha.
Suppatipanno bhagavato savaka sangho sanghang namah.